Galatians, and throughout the week, we've been just looking at these two messages. That the first one is the good news that the Apostle Paul brought and preached to the Galatians. And he said to them, he said, Jesus plus nothing equals everything. But then the agitators came along and they said, no, well, it's great that you've got Jesus, but you now, into your Christian life, you need to add the law, the obeying the law, so that God will approve of you and will accept you. And I was just reflecting this morning, the question was, what makes heaven heaven? What makes heaven special? Remember that question this morning? And what was the answer that Mr. Dawson gave to us? It's Jesus. You see, the center, the glory, the beauty, the focus of heaven is Jesus. We read in about chapter 4 or chapter 5 that there will be a great throng of people, and in the middle of heaven will be sitting on the throne will be the Lamb who was slain. Now, what would heaven be like if people got there on the second equation? Can you imagine a bunch of people getting to heaven based on their own performance and beginning to ask one another, well, how did you get here? Can you imagine the squabbles and the quarrels and the anger and the ostracizing that would go on in heaven if that were the way to get there? But the incredible thing about heaven is that there will be none of that, because every single person who will be there will have got there, not in their own merits, but because of what Jesus did for them on the cross. And it's going to be the most beautiful place, because there will be no more pride and arrogance. There will be humility and there will be gratefulness, because the center, the glory of heaven is Jesus, because that is the only way to get there. And why should we live out that? You know, it's as the Apostle Paul says, how can you be so stupid? And I have to admit to you and confess to you this evening that I have been a stupid Christian. That's the reason why I started studying Galatians a year ago, because as a minister of the gospel, that's supposedly what I should be doing. I was pointing people in counseling, telling them how to sort themselves out by their own effort, instead of pointing them properly to Jesus. So tonight, we're going to finish, and look, I don't care if you don't remember much about what I've said this week. If only you will go away, I'll be really happy if the only thing you do is go away and say, I'm going to read Galatians. Maybe you can send me an email or something like that. That would really cheer me up. But listen, we need to get the good news of Jesus deep into our hearts. And tonight we're going to have a look at how the gospel actually changes the way that we relate to one another, how we treat one another. And so we're going to take a quick reading from Galatians Galatians chapter 5. And we'll read from verse 13, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 13. Galatians chapter 5, verse 13. You, my brothers, were called to be free. But do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command: love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. For the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the sinful nature. They are in conflict with each other, so that you do not do what you want. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Come down to verse 25. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking and envying each other. Brothers, if someone is caught in sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently. But watch yourself, or you may also be tempted. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions. Then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to somebody else, for each one should carry his own load. We pray that the Lord will bless the reading of his word to us tonight. I just want to start with a little bit about the complexity of relationships, and I don't know if you've ever sort of thought this through. It probably appeals to me a bit more than a lot of you just because of my engineering background, but I want you to think for a moment about we've got two people, say they're married. How many relationships have we got going on between them? It's not rocket science. Sorry? One. Yeah. I say two. One each way. All right? My relationship, say with my wife, her relationship back to me. So we have two. Now, what say that little Junior comes into the situation, onto the scene, and now we've got three people. How many relationships do we have now? We've got six. Very good. We've got some mathematicians in the group. Now we add a fourth person into the scene. How many relationships we got going now? 12. That's right. You notice that it's quickly, it's incrementing extremely quickly. Now if we were to jump and we were to take eight people, that's how many relationships are going on. And I think have we got a family of seven? Six? Seven. Seven kids. Okay, so a few more than that. And you quickly see the complexity of the problem. Now, take the camp. How many people, John, have been here this week, roughly? Say 100? Yeah, about 100. Guess how many relationships have been going on this week? 990. No, not too bad. 9,900. You missed a zero. Just a zero. 9,900 relationships in a... All of them needing nurture and care for the camp to be something special. Now, this is why it's so radical that when Jesus said to his disciples, didn't he? He said, by this all men shall know you are my disciples if you love one another. You take all the complexities of all the interpersonal relationships and the care and the nurture that all of them need, and then you add into that selfishness and sinfulness. And yet Jesus is saying that the way that people will know that we are his disciples is if you love one another. And so the question is, well, what is the gospel going to say to the way that we relate to one another? Now, just a little bit of interest. In the 4th century, there was a guy by the name of Simeon Stylite. He's now a saint. There are some times when I would like to do what Simeon did. He went to the edge of the Syrian desert and he built for himself a pillar. At the beginning, it was about 2 meters high, and he lived on that pillar for the next 6 years. He wanted to become close to God and in solitude to be free from worldly distractions. Now, after 6 years, Simeon thought, well, he could do better. And so with the help of some friends, they built the tower up to 60 feet, which is probably maybe even a little bit higher than what's in the drawing there. And he lived there until his death, which occurred 33 years later. As one scholar mused, thinking about St. Simeon Stylite, he said, "I wonder if there was childcare out there in the desert." You see, Simeon may have grown in his devotion to Christ, and he may, in his spiritual search of God, he may have grown, but kind of begs the question, wouldn't Simeon have been a lot more fruitful if he had got down off his column and gone back into the city and begun to restore sinners to carry their burdens, just like Jesus? And Jesus wants us, as we've heard this week, Jesus wants us to be holy people. He wants us to be, he doesn't want us to get messed up in the sin of the world, as Mr. Dawson has taught us this week. But Jesus wants us to become holy, not through isolation, but holy through relationships with one another. And if you have a look in the Bible, in the New Testament, there is a whole list of one another's. Love one another. Encourage one another. And if we isolate ourselves and if we don't practice community as Jesus commands us to, then we are never going to grow. Now, some people have said to me, they don't need to come to church to grow. They don't need to belong to a community to grow. I say to that, rubbish. Now, you can sit in your lounge room, right? And you can, by yourself, and you can think you're quite a nice, loving person. But go into a community, put yourself into a community where there are people rubbing you up the wrong way and you don't particularly get along with them. And then listen to Jesus' words. "By this all men shall know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." Where do you learn to love? You learn to love in community. Where do you learn to serve? In community. Where do you learn from others? In community. And therefore, Jesus placed a high value on community. So tonight we're going to have a look at the Galatian community, and we're going to just look at it very simply under three headings: the strife that the Galatian community was in, the solution to that strife and to that ugliness that was appearing, and the new standard that Jesus expects and sets for the Christian community. Now let's have a look at the first one, the strife. In chapter 5 and verse 15, it is very, very clear that there were problems in the Galatian community. The verse says, if you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. So the Galatian community that had started off as a loving Christian community was now becoming a bitter and a divided one. There was strife in the church in Galatia because the Galatians were beginning to turn away from the good news of Jesus to a gospel that was not good news. And this is what's beginning to happen. They're beginning to bite, they're beginning to devour, and they are beginning to destroy one another. And the outcome always of moving away from the gospel, it's always the same. It always ends up in a breaking down of the Christian community. Now, I just want to turn to two verses in the New Testament to have a look at what the Bible says causes conflict. And then we're going to come back to Galatians, and we're going to have a look and see if we can see that in Galatians. So here's the first verse. I'll just pop them up on the screen, and you don't need to look them up in your own Bible. So just quickly, James chapter 4, verse 1 says this. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. You kill and you covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and you fight. Now, what James is saying is that all quarrels and all fights come from a deep battle that is raging in our hearts. And it's the battle of our desires. Notice what it says. What causes fights and quarrels? Where do they come from? Don't they come, says James, from your desires that battle within your heart? So if you want to sort of put it in maybe in a graphical way, what James is saying is, here's me with my desires, and over there that's you, and I'm more important than you. What I want is more important than what you want. And so James says we begin to see people, because we're driven in our hearts by desires, we begin to see people either as vehicles that will help me and assist me to get what I want, or we see people as obstacles who are getting in the way of what I want. So James says that at the heart of every conflict, whether it be marriage, church, or even between two countries, is always at the bottom of it, the cause or the source of all conflicts is deep desires. Now, let's have a look at another verse, and this one is now from 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 15. And it's the same theme again, this theme of desires, what I want to do. And Paul says to the Corinthians, he says, and Jesus died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but should live for him who died for them and was raised again. In other words, what Paul is saying is that the sin that underlies all sin, the sin that Jesus died for, is the sin of living for ourselves. That's the heart of it. That's the root of it. And because we live for ourselves, our desires, they just drive us. And we are always out there trying to satisfy them, trying to get our own way. And the Apostle Paul said, we learn from Jesus that because he died for us, we as Christians, we can no longer live for ourselves. That's the gospel. Now let's take these two things, this battle of desires, this 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 15, this idea of living for myself. And let's come back to Galatians and let's have a look at what we find. Now there's two verses that I want to point out. Verse 16 of chapter 5 and then verse 18. There's two little expressions in here and I'm going to put them up on the screen so it's easy for you to see. Galatians chapter 5 verse 15 says, so I say to you, live by the Spirit and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. Now verse 18, but if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under law. Now, I don't want you to miss what Paul is getting at here. Because what he's saying is, when you put these two things together, there's this parallel. What he's saying is that gratifying the desires of the flesh and living under the law, they are either very, very, very similar, or maybe they are even exactly the same thing. So when I begin to perform, when I see that my acceptance by God depends on my performance, and I place my life under the law, all right, it's like somebody coming to Australia, to live in Australia. When they arrive in Australia to live here, what they are in essence doing is saying, I am now going to live under Australian rules, Australian law. So if you could get away with some stuff overseas, you won't be able to get away with it in Australia. So when a person wants to perform, says the Apostle Paul, they are putting themselves under the law. And what Paul says is that when you put yourself under the law and you begin to perform for God, the surprising thing that you're doing is you're actually indulging your own sinful nature. Now, at first sight, you think, no, that can't be true. I mean, wouldn't it be advantageous to throw in some rules into the Christian life to kind of, you know, to sturdy up the Christian life, to get better Christians? But what the Apostle Paul says, no, that is not how the gospel functions. That is not how grace functions. That's performance. And when we begin to live under the law, what we are doing is we are performing, we are actually indulging the sinful nature, our own sinful desires. So as the Galatians began to listen to the teaching of the agitators, thinking that they were getting an improved version of Christianity, what they were actually doing was they were beginning to go back. They were beginning to track back into the place that they had come from. So let's put it up here again in a bit of a visual way. The Apostle Paul says earlier in Galatians, he says to them, he says, you were idol worshippers. You were in bondage. You were in slavery. What does an idol worshipper do? Well, he worships idols, he gives his life to idols in order that those idols will give back to him what he is seeking. Is that clear? So, here are these Galatians and they are just completely enslaved to idolatry. They are driven by idols to get what they want. Along comes the Apostle Paul with the glorious gospel of Jesus and says that God, the true and living God, has come and he has given his one and only Son, and through him you are accepted because of what he has done. The Galatians believe the gospel, and what does it say? They were set free. You're free. Now, sometime later, Paul has gone, the agitators have come in, and they've said, no, God expects you to work hard and to perform. The Apostle Paul says, hang on a moment. When you start doing that, you're actually tracking back into the same place. Now, how does it work? Well, just as when you're serving and when you're worshipping idols, you're enslaved to them and you're trying to get from the idols what you want. Living by performance is just doing it in a different way. You use the law to try and get God to give you what you want. And the idea is that if you can be your own savior, then you can be your own Lord. If you can come to God and you can bring before him all the stuff that you've done, the idea is that you're trying to put yourself into a position where God owes you and he needs to give you what you want. In other words, you're just as enslaved as you were worshipping idols, as you are now keeping the law, performing for God. Now, a little story, one of the most famous stories that Jesus told, and we're going to have a look at this, we're going to look at the story in just a couple of minutes. We've just had a few issues with the sound, but we're going to give it a go. The story of the prodigal son. Do you remember the story of the prodigal son? How many brothers? Two. We only talk about one, but there were two. Now, the younger brother, what did he say to his father? He said, Father, give me what's mine. He says, I want to get out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with you. In fact, a person coming to their father and saying, give me my inheritance before the father dies, in ancient Eastern culture, it's like saying to the dad, I wish you were dead. I don't want to have anything to do with you in my life. So he was very bad. He goes off, he wants the father's goods, he wants the farm, he wants the inheritance, but he does not want the father. What about the older brother? Well, the older brother hung around, didn't he? He worked really hard. He was really good. But when the younger brother came back, his character, it just was all exposed. And on the happiest day of the father's life, when the older brother should have been enjoying and rejoicing to see his father so happy, what is he doing? He's standing outside because there's a party going on. The father has thrown a party for the younger brother, and he's standing outside. And what does it say? He was angry. Why was he angry? Because the father was using his goods, what was going to be his portion, on the younger brother. In other words, the older brother wanted the father's goods, but he was not interested in the father himself. He was just going about it in a different way. So idol worshipping, you might say, is like younger brother approach. I'll rebelliously, I will get what I want. But the Apostle Paul says, keeping the law is like the older brother trying to be good, trying to perform, so that at the end of the day, you can come to the Father and you can say, you owe me. Isn't that what the older brother said? I've been slaving here for years, and where's my party? You haven't put a party on for me. What did he want? He wanted the Father's goods, but his way of going about it was to perform so that he could be in a position of bargaining. Now that, those two things are exact, they are just different expressions of selfishness and of indulging the sinful nature. In one of them, I'm outwardly rebellious and I'm saying to God, get lost. In the other, there's a polite veneer of goodness. But underneath, all I'm doing is I'm just trying to get from God what I want, and I will do it my way. Because if I can save myself, then I can be my own boss. So, there's a total legalism and performance in the Galatian church. They were ripping the Galatian church to pieces, because legalism and performance is a total preoccupation with self. I trust myself to get what I want my own way. Notice me, me, me. Now, how does this work itself out in relationships? Well, I want you to read with me verse 26. So keep in mind, there's this total focus on self and this I am completely consumed with what I can do. I am now trusting in myself. And notice what it says, let us not become conceited, provoking and envying each other. Now, that word conceit is another way to explain it, is the word vainglory, or if you want to, empty of honor. I am hungry for honor. I am trying to get things. I am trying to earn my own way. And so I need to add to my life worth and value. You understand what I'm saying? I need to get something. I am trying to perform for God. I've got to show to God that I'm valuable and that I deserve it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to try to stuff my life with honor. And you'll notice that the outcome of this living for yourself and indulging the sinful nature and trying to perform for God, the outcome is that we either end up provoking one another or we end up envying one another. It makes sense, doesn't it? When I am performing, what am I doing all the time? What am I doing? But I'm comparing myself, aren't I, with others? Notice what it says, chapter 6, verse 4, at the end of verse 4. Let's read the verse together. Each one should test his own actions, then he can take pride in himself. Notice what the Apostle Paul says, without comparing himself to somebody else. So what Paul is saying is this whole performance thing, it just makes everybody compare themselves to everybody else. And what's the outcome of comparing yourself as you are hungry for honor, you're trying to fill your life with worth and value? What are the two outcomes? Here they are. We've just read them in the verse. Here I am, here's empty me, trying to stuff my life with honor and with value. I'm doing it through performance. And what are the two outcomes? The first one is that sometimes I will be very confident. And the whole idea of the word provoke means that I'm so confident that I'm actually going to take you on. So this idea of looking down at other people and despising people and belittling others because I'm doing better than they are. Now, the opposite is that sometimes we will be in despair. And we will look at others who are doing better than ourselves and we will envy them. So in the bottom one, I am confident, I'm arrogant, but I'm not humble. And in the top one, I'm humble, I'm using that word for want of a better word, I'm humble, but I am not confident. And when we're in either one of these categories, we are of no use. There is no way that we can actually love our brother and our sister. So in other words, you might put it this way, that sometimes We feel superior, and sometimes we feel inferior. When I'm feeling superior, then I feel that I'm better than you are, and I'm going to prove it to you. When I feel inferior, I feel that you are better than I am, and I resent it. You know what? We live a lot of our life like this. Sometimes, you know, we oscillate between the two, we feel very confident. Other times we feel total in despair. And the Apostle Paul says that these two outcomes are the outcomes of a performance-driven life. And you'll notice that the way that we are constantly looking at people is in a vertical way. We're putting everybody on a scale and we're seeing people either ahead of us or people below us. What did Jesus say? Love your neighbor as yourself. So we need, something needs to happen. We need something that is going to speak to us and is going to deal with both the envy and the provocation. And this is where the solution comes in for the gospel community. What is the gospel of God's grace? Well, here's just the beauty, the sheer beauty of the gospel. The gospel of God's grace says to me that I am more sinful than I ever dared believe. What does the gospel do? The first thing the gospel does, it attacks your arrogance. Because the gospel says you need a savior. You can't do it by yourself. So the gospel attacks my arrogance, my provocation. But the gospel also says to me that I am more loved than I ever dared hope. You know, I've been, I was just thinking this afternoon, just meditating through these verses. Every religious system in the world either leaves you very confident or just in total despair. The gospel is the only message that allows us to grow both in humility and in confidence at the same time, and where neither the humility eats up the confidence or the confidence eats up the humility. Isn't that incredible? I can come to Jesus, and his word, his good, the good news, it's going to humble me, because the more I see and read and understand the good news, the more I see how sinful I were and how much grace God has shown towards me. And yet at the same time, that very same grace is giving me confidence and boldness to stand before him and to say, I am accepted in Jesus. The problem is that if we are in one of the two, if we are super confident, we're no good to somebody who's in need, are we? If you look what it says, chapter 6, verse 1, brothers, if somebody falls into sin, you who are spiritual should restore him. Would you like to be restored by a super arrogant, provoking person? He's going to come along and he's going to prove to you just how bad you are. But neither is somebody who has this false sense of humility and who thinks that they're so, you know, I'm just so rotten, I can't do anything. Neither are of any good in the Christian community. And what I want to say to you tonight is that what radically changes the Christian community is a deep understanding of the gospel that makes us both humble and confident at the same time. I am more sinful than I ever dared believe, but I am more loved than I ever dared hope. That is the good news of the gospel, and that begins to transform relationships. Because now, no longer am I looking at people and despising them or resenting them. I'm now seeing my brother as exactly myself. I see both of us in the same, exactly the same position. We are both, we're totally hopeless. We're, as my one of my friends says, the church is just full of beggars telling others where they can find food. That's what the Christian community is all about. We're all sinful. And the gospel levels all of us. But it also gives us an enormous confidence before God that encourages us to begin to love our neighbor as ourselves. Now I'm going to stop there. There's more stuff that I was going to share, but I think I should just stop there. And we're going to have a look now at the parable of the prodigal son. And the reason I want to show you the parable is because both were estranged. We've talked about it a little bit tonight. And I have a feeling, well, I know that all of us are in one of the two camps and that all of us need to hear the good news again of Jesus. So just give us half a second. Paul and I will...
Hi, I'm good, thank you. Nice to see you. Hey,
congratulations.
Thank you
congratulations.
Very much.
All that hard work.
Yeah, well,
great job.
Thank you.
It's inspiration.
Thanks, very nice of you to say that.
Thank you.
Hey, Lisa.
This is so fantastic.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks so much. Hey, Paul.
It's great. Good to
see you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Hey, thank you. Hey. Hey. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hawthorne, yeah. I have to talk to you. Your brother came home today, and your dad's throwing this party to welcome him back.
He's going to ruin the company. I closed a $15 million deal today, and he's going to flush it down the toilet. But don't misunderstand me. I love my father. He's a great man. He built this company into what it is today. But he could ruin everything we have created by doing this. It sends the wrong message. When Jake pulled his ownership out of the company, it was a fiscal nightmare. You know, we had to slash salaries, we had to liquidate assets. 89 families depend on us for their salaries every single month. Mortgages went unpaid. You know, credit cards were maxed out. We lost some of our best people. And Jake's view on all this?
It's our money anyway. Nobody's going to starve. People don't starve anymore.
Jake, grow up. Stop acting like a fool.
Lazy fool. Don't forget the lazy part.
No one is going to agree to this, Jake. The board will
the
never
board
agree.
The board is in Dad's pocket. You know they're a bunch of yes men.
There's no way Dad's going to agree to it either.
He'll do it. I've already talked to him about it. Yeah, he wasn't too excited about it. For a minute, I thought he might explode. But he calmed down, and he asked if it was what I really wanted.
Do you have any idea what this is going to do to the company? You don't care. You make me sick.
Rich. I make you rich. Come on, you're throwing me softballs here, Andy. Anyway, if he's going to do it, he has to split everything between the two of us. Oh, you didn't know that, did you? See, that changes things a little bit. See, now that's $1 million for you, $1 million for me, $1 million for you, $1 million for me.
It's not about the money, Jake.
No, it isn't, is it? Never has been for you. But it is about ownership, am I right? Control? See, now this way, we both get what we want. Freedom for me, ownership for you. And we get it while we're young enough to enjoy it. See, now old and rich, that's a tragedy.
All right. But this is your choice, Jake. It's not mine. I'm not going to have anything to do with it.
Of course not. Not a thing. You just sit back and do nothing, and it'll all be yours.
He thought I was going along with it, but to be honest, and I know this sounds harsh, he was a cancer, needed to be cut out. So, now he's giving it all back to him. Incredible. After Jake left, my father used to come in here and just sit. You know? Jake played him like a poker hand, and my father just... Well, he always had a soft spot for Jake. But this time, he went too far, and the board knew it.
This is corporate suicide.
It's not suicide.
And it's voluntary amputation. And we'll bleed to death.
Jake will be here any minute.
Call it what you will, but it won't sink the company. Painful, yes,
painful?
But...
This is going to be financial agony for months.
Financial insanity.
It could sink the company. To imagine giving such
a slacker, a
self-serving upstart this much money.
Just not right.
Gentlemen! I understand where you are. I appreciate where you are, but I've made up my mind.
You realize what Jake is saying here, don't you?
He's saying it loud and clear.
Gentlemen, no.
He's saying he wants you dead. Yes. That's right. By asking for his inheritance now, he's saying he wants
you dead. That's enough, Roy!
Andrew. Surely you have more to add to all this. We've been sitting here for hours. What did you say to him?
We're better off without him.
He doesn't want to be here, so I say we let him go. My father's right. We can survive the liquidation.
The way this has been set up has you taking ownership of the rest of your father's stock.
In name only. From a legal standpoint, it has to be done. But as I have stated, I want my father to retain full control of the company.
Sit down, Jake. Gentlemen, let's get this over with.
So, what happened to all that money? Let's see. If he had... He was gone for... That means he would have been spending... $8,756,944 a year. $729,745 a month. $162,165 a week. $23,166 a day. $965 an hour. $16 a minute. And 26 cents a second. Every second, another 26 cents. And another. And another, and another, and another. But at some point, time ran out for him. Maybe then he realized that he'd tied a noose around his own neck. Well, probably not. Finding a job would have been out of the question. Jake just doesn't work. He once told me his knees hurt if he sat behind a desk for too long.
You were a healthcare VP? You? No kidding.
Figured I'd seen it all, but with this recession... Yep.
So, you have something?
Not really. Well, tell you what. You having so much experience with the stiffs in the executive suite, I think I might have something for you. With your skills, probably a perfect fit.
No. I know Jake. The moment the last penny was gone, which was probably just a few days ago, he pulled out a credit card and hopped on a plane for home. It was time for greener pastures.
See those guys? My dad hires guys like that.
There are many good ones. We just have to stop the bleeding.
Yeah, you've got a great point.
So you've said, bro.
They make all kinds of cash. Listen, I've been thinking, and I know what I've got to do.
Well, you got it all figured out now, do you?
I go back, I tell him how stupid I've been.
For losing his millions, huh?
And I ask him to make me a middle manager in one of the hospitals the company supervises. I'll have a job, and I'll be out from under Andy's thumb.
Dude, if I lost all that money and came back wanting more, my father would take a 2x4 to me.
Not more money, just a job. Anyway, my dad's not like that.
Oh.
He's a good guy.
He must be dumber than you look. Because, bro, I'd give my right arm for a dad like that.
Get to mopping, rich boy.
And the one, he never felt a twinge of remorse. Not a twinge. All he cared about was getting the money. My money. But he's in for a rude awakening. The facts are quite simple. I own the controlling shares of the company. I have final say on what happens here, what we should be spending our money on, and what we most certainly should not. Sure, my father's still in his position of authority. He thinks he's calling the shots. It's fine. He looks better that way.
Can I call you back?
No more drowning in my pride. I'll just ride on the back of the angel.
Dad, I'm really sorry. I want you to...
Jake, where have you been?
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I lost you. It's all gone.
It's all gone. It's all right.
I don't deserve to
be. It's all right.
It's all right. I don't deserve the job.
Come on. Let's go inside.
Mr. Hawthorne?
I think you remember Karen.
It's good to see you again, Mr. Hawthorne.
Call Clary's and tell them we're having a party tonight here at the office. I want steaks. I want their best food. Spare no expense. Oh, Karen, isn't it wonderful to see him again?
Yes, sir. And for how many people?
The entire office. Oh, and call the board, too. Tell them I want them here with me to welcome Jake back.
Yes, sir.
And I'm thinking that Jake's old office is still available?
The other Mr. Hawthorne is using part of it to store his files.
Well, have the files put in storage and get the office cleaned up. Jake is going to be starting back on Monday. Make sure you let the staff know. Oh, and tell everybody they've got the rest of the day off.
Yes,
tonight,
sir.
We're going to celebrate my son coming home.
Such a waste of money. It's It's my responsibility to look after the best interest of this company. I find it absolutely inexcusable that my father continues to drain this company's bank accounts for him. Well, this is it. Time for some serious changes. I can't. I won't let him ruin this company.
Join us in welcoming back your brother. It would mean so much to your father.
Please relay to my father that it won't be possible for me to do that. You tell him that I have work to finish.
But
tell him.
Andrew! I know what you're thinking, but please.
You know what I'm thinking? You have no idea what I'm thinking.
Just come in and say hello to your brother. It would mean
so much. It would mean that I approve of this idiocy. He spent it all, hasn't he?
Andrew?
Hasn't he? I know he has. I know he has. He wouldn't be back if he hadn't.
He's your brother, Andrew.
He's your son. He has just flushed away tens of millions of dollars of this company's hard-earned money on drugs and whores, and now you are spending how many thousands more on this? It makes me sick!
My son, don't do this.
I will do it. I will. Somebody has to take a stand for what's right. Do you have any idea how this looks?
Andrew, listen to me.
No. No, you listen to me. I am the one who has slaved away for you for almost 2 decades building this company into what it is. I secured a $15 million contract for this company today. You owe me.
Andrew.
When have you ever done anything like this for me? When? You've never done anything like, you've never even thrown a party for me and my friends.
Andrew, you've always been here for me. And you know that everything I have is yours.
Then where's my party? Where is my party, Father?
Your own brother.
Where is my party?
Good
you are rewarding the wrong person. He does not deserve this. He doesn't deserve this.
And he's back with us safe and sound.
Yeah, and broke.
Yeah, I'm broke. It was my money. Why do you care?
Yeah, that was your money. Mm-hmm. This is my money. It's my money, and I don't want it spent on...
Celebrate your brother coming home. Andrew, look at yourself. Look at yourself. Your brother is home. If there was ever a reason to celebrate, this is it. My son, come into the party. Come in.
Just about it.